Blog Talk Radio.
Video casting the show, even though you can hear better on Blog Talk Radio, you can see what we're doing. If you will go to, I don't know if the link's here or not, go to, wow, George, do you know how to tell people to get to WebEx? I don't know if that's on our site. Look at soundhealthoptions.com, and I've just noticed that it's got the wrong date on it, so I don't know if it's going to bring you in and how to do this. You may be able to go to through a different route. George, I'm going to open your mic because I've heard you talk about how other ways that people could go watch. So can you talk about that a minute?
Yes, you can go if you're viewing Sherry's regular WebEx, you can go over to Blog Talk Radio and on there is better. However, I haven't figured out how to post anything to the Blog Talk Radio chat.
Okay, well, I think sometimes people have told me they can go to our site or they can be on our email address or they can go to webec.com and just look for Sound Health and they can see a listing of shows that are going on and go ahead and be able to join that way. So most of you, some of you names I do not recognize, so you may be coming from a new source, but if you'll go to radio shows on our site, soundhealthoptions.com, you can watch the video broadcast of what we're doing. For those of you who haven't been with us before, we usually do a small introduction, and then we have a subject that we talk about. Today we're going to talk about vaccinations, mandated vaccinations, how that's not a good idea. And it joins with a free class that we did yesterday, and that free class was about vaccination risk factors. And we are providing that class, the manual, and the software for testing for pre-vaccination risk. That will be rerun, that whole show will be rerun next weekend from Friday at 5 till Monday at noon so that you can watch the show. We have a lot of people from other countries, and their time is upside down from us, so it's very hard for them to be able to catch the workshop. You can hear a rerun of this show probably a half hour or so after the show ends. This is our support of the idea of get healthy and stay healthy, because that's not something the government is going to help us do. If you'll look at the recent issue of Time magazine, it says how to die, and it gives you instructions in there about how to kill off your parents early and get a check from the government. And you may think I'm totally bizarre in saying that to you, but that's part of what it covers. So we're going to be talking about that today in this Blog Talk Radio show, but right after this, we're going to be showing two videos about how the government is really trying to cut their health costs by helping us die early. A lot of times right before the show, I get letters, and I got a profound letter today that I wanted to share with you. It says, "Dear Miss Edwards, thank you for your efforts to retain and regroup the people to be proactive in terms of their own health. Not only is the problem in healthcare overt, but very obvious to everyone who can think for themselves. But it's also equally obvious to those who are trained and who are being forced into vaccinations we don't need and then left to rot when we get ill ourselves." Here's an excerpt from a recent Reader's Digest that makes my point, and it's signed Joe, and it's Slammon or Salt Slammon, well, Slammon, S-L-A-M-O-N. Joe, thank you for your letter, and thank you for this excerpt. It is short, and then we'll go right in to our information with Barbara Lowe Fisher about what's going on. This is called The Corpsman, and it's by Eric Smith, age 27, been in the Navy for 6 years. "You might have overlooked the man in a blue service uniform quietly mopping floors at MedStar Union Memorial Hospital in Baltimore last year. But not so long ago, Eric Smith was wearing military garb and performing emergency medical procedures on wounded soldiers in Iraq. Since returning from the battlefront in 2008, after two tours of duty, however, the former Navy hospital corpsman had been out of work and underemployed. Smith enlisted at 17 and by 19 was leading a four-man team at a 20-bed hospital zone. But his life-saving skills are not recognized by stateside medical facilities that demand civilian certification and licensing. Smith and thousands of other highly trained and experienced vets don't qualify for jobs equivalent to or less demanding than ones they held in the military. Back home in Baltimore, Smith has found only menial jobs. All the things I was trained to do are going to waste, he says ruefully. It cost the Navy, the American people, really, $1 million in nearly 6 years to train me, and it's all for nothing. Now 27, Smith is going back to school to earn an EMT certificate that will allow him to perform the same tasks he did in so well under battlefield conditions. The war at home, he says, is tougher than the war overseas. Yes. And the biggest war we face is the war, well, several wars. And I was checking to see if we were recording. One of the biggest wars we face is mandated vaccinations. No exemptions, even if it's medical, even if you've had trouble before, even if your child is going to die. No exemptions, except for Muslims. And I don't remember the other, Muslims and, I can't believe I shut that down, here it is, and the Amish. No, the Amish and the Muslims, both on religious ground. But one of the things Obama has said is everyone must be vaccinated if this is going to work. But if you start giving all these exemptions and exemptions for these workers and those workers, then you got a problem. And now we have forced vaccinations for healthcare workers. And some of them are losing their job because they are refusing to get inundated with 60, 70 vaccines. In the Army, sometimes 70 vaccines in a three-day period. That's crazy. And one of the people that I have supported all along about vaccines, because she gives the truth and she provides truthful research, which you really don't see out there when you've got a doctor saying, "I won't treat you anymore, I won't see your baby if you don't get him vaccinated." They have not been told the truth. So this is Barbara Lowe Fisher, and I don't remember when this was done. It's very recent. But for those of you who are watching us you can see this speech being prepared. For those of you who are just listening, you can go to YouTube under Barbara Lowe Fisher, L-O-E Fisher, and it's called Vaccine Safety Conference Opening Address. I'll tell you, people, this will make you cry in part.
Barbara Lowe Fisher, co-founder and president of the National Vaccine Information Center, presented the opening address at the 2011 Trial Vaccine Safety Conference, speaking on medical science and public trust, the policy, ethics, and law of vaccination in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Before I begin my presentation, I do want to add my thanks to Claire and Al Dawson, whose vision and support of this conference has made it possible for us to be here today. Our paths crossed in 2006, and since then, their encouragement and support of the work we do at the National Vaccine Information Center has kept the organized vaccine safety and informed consent movement going strong. Thank you to both of you for all you've done to advance truth in science and protect the right to informed consent to vaccination. We have come together to evaluate vaccine safety science because there is a crisis upon us. And this crisis is fueled by a loss of public trust in what many doctors tell people about the safety of vaccines and the risks of infectious diseases. In the second decade of the 21st century, almost everyone knows someone who was healthy, got vaccinated, and was never healthy again. That anecdotal evidence is in part fueling a loss of public confidence in the quality and quantity of the science used to justify mandatory vaccination policies. In the late 20th century, public questioning of vaccine safety began in Europe, with persistent reports of healthy children dying and becoming brain injured after receipt of DPT vaccine, and with the launching of the vaccine safety and informed consent movement by American parents of DPT vaccine-injured children in 1982. It was legitimized by the passage of the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 that shielded vaccine makers and providers from vaccine injury liability, and has been building ever since, as dozens of new vaccinations that do not fit the smallpox or polio model have been added to mandatory vaccination laws in the past three decades. While reports of vaccine-related chronic health problems and deaths have increased, and doctors inside and outside of government have continued to dismiss vaccine-related injuries and deaths as coincidental. The challenge to doctors promoting mandated use of vaccines by everyone from day of birth throughout life is being led in large part by the educated middle-class healthcare consumer in developed countries. Educated healthcare consumers make up about 40% of the U.S. population, or roughly 100 million adults, who have earned an associate, bachelor's, or graduate college degree. I am typical of the 40% of educated middle-class Americans who spend more than $19 billion every year to avoid genetically modified foods and chemicals by eating organic. We also pay more than $34 billion from alternative healthcare professionals, including chiropractic, acupuncture, homeopathy, naturopathy, nutrition, exercise, and bio.
I am having a problem here with Blog Talk because they're threatening to cut me off. It says 90 seconds is all they're going to allow us to go on. So I guess we'll need to switch over. This is really ridiculous. And I don't know what to do about it. They have cut the show to like a half hour or something. Well, it looks like they've cut the show to 15 minutes. Go to soundhealthoptions.com and see if you can join through WebEx. This is just crazy.
Feedback programs. I also count myself among the 69% of Americans who doctors prescribe too many prescription drugs because they are too heavily influenced by pharmaceutical companies. Most importantly, I am among the 9 out of 10 American parents who, when polled in 2010, said our number one healthcare concern was vaccine safety. Like most educated healthcare consumers, I do not have a medical degree. However, I am quite capable of doing my own research, including assessing the quality of scientific studies published in the medical literature if I put my mind to it. I want to trust what my doctor tells me about infectious diseases and vaccines, but I also want to empower myself with information so that I can ask my doctor intelligent questions and independently weigh the potential benefits or risks of vaccination for myself and my children. I expect my doctor to work with me as an equal partner and respect the choices I make, because I believe it is my right and responsibility to make well-informed healthcare choices for myself and my children based on the best evidence I can find. Bottom line, I represent the empowered, educated healthcare consumer of the 21st century, who is changing the practice of medicine because I am taking control of my health and the health of my children by moving toward a new health paradigm that is based more on respect for the natural order than on indiscriminate use of pharmaceutical products. When I became a mother for the first time in 1978, there was no information about vaccines available for the American healthcare consumer. Detailed information about vaccine benefits and risks was published in medical journals, but it was only available to doctors with subscriptions to those journals or with access to medical libraries in hospitals and universities. College-educated mothers like me were old enough to remember that polio vaccine saved us from the iron lung, and we believed that vaccines were 100% safe and effective for everyone, especially our children. It is difficult for young parents today who grew up with computers, cell phones, and the World Wide Web to imagine what it was like in the 1980s when very few families had computers, or what it was like before 1995 when most people did not have cell phones or access to the library of the world on the Internet. The electronic mass communications revolution has taken healthcare consumers out of the dark ages and jettisoned them into a modern age of enlightenment. We are in the middle of an information renaissance, where with a click of a mouse or a touch of a smartphone, we have at our fingertips a diverse collection of facts with which to make informed healthcare decisions for ourselves and our children. The educated healthcare consumer in the 21st century is using instant access to more information than has been available to any generation before to challenge the centuries-old paternalistic authoritarian practice of medicine. Educated healthcare consumers are engaging in critical thinking and questioning the science that buttresses public health policies, including vaccine policies. Demanding an equal partnership with physicians in making healthcare choices for themselves and their children, they are refusing to trust without verifying. And this, at the dawn of the 21st century, is signaling an end to unquestioning public trust that was automatically accorded to medical doctors and scientists in the 19th and 20th centuries. This historic challenge is coming at precisely the same time that doctors and scientists associated with government, industry, academia, and organized medicine are wielding more influence over what kind of healthcare information is made available to the public through the mainstream media, while seeking more authority over what kinds of healthcare choices individuals are allowed to make. When I got pregnant in the late 1970s, I joined with other middle-class, college-educated women who were pregnant for the first time and signed up for prepared childbirth classes taught by women. We had come of age in the 1960s during the civil rights, women's liberation, and environmental protection movements that challenged powerful social institutions and celebrated individual autonomy and empowerment. And we decided we were not going to blindly trust and follow the orders of mostly male obstetricians. We were going to take control of our pregnancy and childbirth by becoming educated about prenatal nutrition and limiting our exposures to environmental toxins that could hurt our baby. Unlike mothers delivering babies in the 40s and 50s who were drugged into unconsciousness during labor and delivery, we decided we did not want to follow doctors' orders and subject our babies and ourselves to the toxic effects of heavy anesthesia, so we missed celebrating the moments our babies were born. And despite what doctors told us about the joys of bottle feeding, we were going to breastfeed our babies for at least 6 months rather than go straight to formula, because our research told us the breast was best for our newborn baby's health. When it came to birthing babies, we were going to put our trust in nature, our own bodies, and our mother's instincts, rather than put our trust in medical doctors and pharmaceutical companies. But in the 1970s, nobody was talking about vaccines. Given to healthy people to keep them well, vaccines were not viewed as pharmaceutical products marketed by drug companies for profit, but as sacred magic bullets that shielded children from an unpredictable attack by dangerous microorganisms that cause sickness and death. And young, educated mothers like me, who had experienced and recovered from measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox as children, did not use the same critical thinking skills or instincts to take control of neonatal pediatric care that we had used in making decisions about our labor and delivery. We trusted the pediatricians and the vaccines they gave our children would do no harm. As the father of America's holistic health care movement, Dr. Robert Mendelson, pointed out in 1979, for pediatricians and parents alike, vaccination had become the new sacrament. It was in that dark age, more than 30 years ago, that I faithfully took my firstborn, Chris, to the pediatrician for the required well baby checkups. Chris was a happy, precocious baby who exceeded normal developmental milestones and started saying his first words at 7 months and was speaking in full sentences by the age of 2. As a baby and toddler, he was the most precocious of my 3 children. After Chris's 3rd DPT shot, a hard, red-hot, painful lump developed at the site of the injection that stayed there for weeks, and I called the doctor's office. The nurse told me it was a bad lot of DPT vaccine and not to worry about it. My faith in the safety of vaccines and in my pediatrician was so complete, I said to her, "Should I bring him down for another one?" I thought she meant the vaccine was not potent enough and that my baby would be left unprotected. It never occurred to me that the unusual lump had anything to do with safety and was a warning sign that Chris could have a more serious reaction to his next shot. When it came time for Chris's 4th DPT shot in the fall of 1980, he was 2.5 years old, and my bright, cheerful little boy had continued to reach developmental milestones ahead of his peers. He had memorized the name of every card in the deck. He was already identifying words in the books we read together every day. One doctor told me he was cognitively gifted. The day my mom and I took him for his 4th DPT and oral polio vaccinations, Chris had just come off a round of antibiotics that he had been prescribed, for him after he had a 48-hour bout with the flu 3 weeks earlier. He was not running a fever. He was bouncing around like usual, but he had mild diarrhea, perhaps from the antibiotics, and the doctor examining him dismissed it as unimportant. Several hours after we got home, I noticed the house was very quiet. I went looking for Chris and found him in the bedroom, sitting motionless in a rocking chair, staring straight ahead as if he couldn't see me in the doorway. His face was pale, and as I called out his name, I watched his eyes flutter back and roll so I could see the whites of his eyes. Then his head fell to his shoulder like he'd fallen asleep sitting up. I tried to wake him up, but he did not respond, and when I picked him up, he was like a dead weight in my arms as I carried him to his bed, and he lay there without moving. Later that afternoon, I wondered why he was sleeping so soundly and for so long, but I thought maybe he was just taking an unusually long nap, or maybe he was coming down with something like a relapse of the flu and his body needed extra sleep. His forehead was cool, not hot, so I told myself to just let him sleep. By dinner time, he had been out for 5 or 6 hours, and I called my mom. She told me I needed to wake him up so he could eat dinner, but Chris did not respond to my calling his name, no matter how loud I called it. Finally, I got into the bed. I put his back against my chest, and I rocked him back and forth, calling his name. Slowly, with great difficulty, he struggled to consciousness and started incoherently mumbling words. I could not understand until I heard the word bathroom. His face was still pale. He was like a limp rag doll in my arms. He could not sit up or stand up, and so I carried him to the bathroom and held him while he had violent black-colored diarrhea, which I took as a sign he was having a relapse of the flu. He fell back into a deep sleep, and I carried him back to his bed where he slept for 12 more hours. The next day, he seemed unusually quiet, and over the next few weeks, I started noticing he was different. He seemed distant, often unconnected to what was going on around him. His eyes, now ringed with dark circles, had lost their brightness and had a vacant look. He started staring a lot, sometimes drooling slightly while he was staring. He was constantly sick with ear and respiratory infections and had chronic foamy diarrhea that looked like attic insulation. He became a picky eater, lost weight, stopped growing. He no longer knew how to identify the deck of cards or the words in the books we had read together every day. He changed from a focused, happy, adaptable little boy into a child who could not concentrate for more than a few seconds at a time and had a very low tolerance for frustration. He would fly into a rage and cry inconsolably whenever he failed to do what he used to be able to do. After 8 months of the health deterioration, with his pediatricians patting me on the head and telling me not to worry because it was just the stage he was going through, I took Chris to another pediatrician who took one look at him and said he was suffering from cystic fibrosis or celiac disease. When the tests came back that were performed at the major children's hospital came back negative, the doctors put him on a diet of white rice, cranberry juice, and white chicken and told me to take him home and love him. My family and I knew Chris had become a totally different child physically, mentally, and emotionally in the fall of 1980, but we did not know why. 18 months later, in April 1982, I turned on the television and watched the Emmy Award-winning television documentary, DBT Vaccine Roulette, produced by NBC reporter Lee Thompson. This was the first time American parents had been informed that a routine childhood vaccine could brain damage children. And my first instinct was that I had to learn more, so I called the station and asked for copies of the supporting medical literature. My confirmation came when I was reading articles in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the British Medical Journal, the Lancet Pediatrics and New England Journal of Medicine, that contained detailed clinical descriptions of the symptoms of post-pertussis vaccine-induced convulsions, hypotonic hyporesponsive episodes, and encephalitis, which exactly matched the symptoms of what I had witnessed my son suffer within hours of his fourth DPT shot. I realized with shock and a profound sense of betrayal that medical researchers and doctors had been talking to each other about the brain damaging effects of pertussis vaccine for more than 50 years, but they never bothered to tell the mothers, dutifully bringing their children in to be vaccinated. That failure to communicate is why I did not know how to monitor my son for symptoms of convulsion, collapse, shock, and brain inflammation following DPT vaccination, and why he could have died in his bed that night, and I would never have known why. Reading the clinical descriptions of DPT vaccine reactions in the literature, I realized that if Chris had been a four-month-old baby and not a precocious two-and-a-half-year-old, the regression he underwent following vaccination may not have been so immediately and dramatically apparent. I thought about how many mothers are not with their child, like I was, to witness a convulsion and collapse shock, which could easily occur in the middle of the night in a crib, and how many babies are regressing after unidentified vaccine reactions, but are not diagnosed until long after the damage has occurred, which prevents even a temporal relationship between vaccine reaction symptoms and brain dysfunction from being recognized. By age 7, Chris was diagnosed with minimal brain damage that took the form of multiple learning disabilities, including attention deficit disorder, auditory processing deficit, fine and gross motor skill delay, dyslexia, and severe sequential short-term memory delay. He had to be withdrawn from Montessori school and placed in a special education classroom in the public school system. Testing revealed that Chris had retained a remarkable ability to engage in abstract thinking, which is a high cognitive function, testing in the 99th percentile, but he tested in the less than 1 percentile of the brain's ability to organize incoming information, which is a very basic cognitive function. That meant he would be able to debate the meaning of Plato's Republic. But if you gave him 3 tasks to do in order, he could remember 2, but not in the right order. A frustrated kid who got into a lot of trouble because he could reflect upon the fact he was constantly failing in school no matter how hard he tried, Chris could not be mainstreamed even in high school. There are many times I have wondered how many learning disabled, hyperactive teenagers and young adults who are high school dropouts or end up on drugs or in prison or suffering with crippling depression are unrecognized, uncounted vaccine injury casualties. The milder forms of vaccine-induced brain inflammation and chronic brain dysfunction actually may be the more prevalent because they remain the most underdiagnosed, yet the effect on society is just as profound. Like most learning disabled children and adults filling special education classrooms in the ranks of the underemployed, Chris still struggles to both hide and compensate for his learning disabilities and the discrepancy between what people expect him to do and what he actually can do. At 33, he is a vaccine reaction survivor. a fine young man, a great conversationalist and videographer. Who knows, he could have been hurt a lot worse that day in 1980. Chris is among the walking wounded, a growing minority of mildly brain-injured adults who were part of that first wave of learning disabled children in the 1980s for whom special education classrooms had to be built. Were he and his classmates, the canaries in the coal mine, a harbinger of what was to come, ignored because as German immunologist and early DPT vaccine safety critic Dr. Wolfgang Ehrengut once suggested, what must not be cannot be. When my three children were born, between the late 70s and 1988, doctors were giving children 23 doses of 7 vaccines, starting at 2 months old, including diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus in the combination DPT shot, oral polio vaccine, and measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines in the combination MMR shot. This was the first generation of children who did not experience most of those once prevalent childhood diseases. That child vaccination schedule stands in stark contrast to the one used in the mid-1940s, when doctors were giving children one dose of smallpox vaccine and several doses of diphtheria and tetanus vaccine in the first 2 years of life, and the majority of children did experience and recover from measles, mumps, rubella, pertussis, and many other infections, including chickenpox and influenza. In 2000, doctors were giving children 33 doses of 10 vaccines, starting on the day of birth, and the special ed classrooms built in the 1980s were overflowing, not only with hundreds of thousands of learning disabled children, but with autistic children exhibiting much more severe brain and immune system dysfunction. By 2010, U.S. public health officials and medical organizations were telling doctors to give children 69 doses of 16 vaccines, starting on the day of birth through age 18, with 48 of those vaccinations given before age 6. Today, unprecedented numbers of American children are suffering with brain and immune system dysfunction. One child in 6 is learning disabled. One in 110 develops autism. One in 9 has asthma. One in 450 becomes diabetic. Millions more suffer with crippling immune system disorders marked by acute and chronic inflammation, including juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disorders, severe allergies to casein, gluten, and peanuts, while obesity, depression, and suicide is also increasing among children. In the past 3 decades, U.S. public health officials have enlisted medical scientists and doctors in industry, academia, and trade associations to persuade state legislators to pass laws legally requiring children to get at least 3 dozen doses of vaccines to attend daycare or school, including college. This is more than 10 times as many vaccinations as were given in the early 20th century. This one-size-fits-all universally applied public health policy to eradicate a growing list of microorganisms using every vaccine that the pharmaceutical industry develops has created the most highly vaccinated population in the world. And it has driven down the incidence of once common childhood diseases, such as chickenpox, to historic lows in the U.S. But there is an elephant standing in the middle of the room, and it cannot be ignored any longer. The inquisitive, well-educated healthcare consumer who is being asked to buy and use more and more vaccines every year sees that elephant quite clearly and is demanding answers to 2 big questions. The first question is, why do the most highly vaccinated children in the world have one of the worst infant mortality rates among developed nations, and why are they experiencing an unprecedented chronic disease and disability epidemic that is crippling the health of more of them than any infectious disease epidemic in our nation's history? This question leads to the second big question. Has the increased administration of multiple vaccines throughout childhood during the past half century, especially in the first 3 years of life, when the brain and immune systems develop most rapidly, been an unrecognized cofactor in the epidemics of chronic disease and disability plaguing so many American children and adults today? These are 2 multi-billion-dollar questions that the third largest country in the world faces as we struggle to pay an annual $2 trillion for health care, the majority of it to treat chronically ill and disabled children and adults, and begin to understand that both individual and public health is not measured by an absence of experience with infectious disease. It is more importantly measured by an absence of chronic disease. For future generations, the health care price tag is as unimaginable as the incalculable human cost if we cannot immediately find a way to stop the hijacking of our children's brains and immune systems. In the search for answers, no stone should be left unturned and no scientific hypothesis should be left off the table. All hypotheses, no matter how politically incorrect or inconvenient, must be fully explored using sound methodology and maintaining high ethical standards. A diverse group of experts representing many different disciplines will be needed to do this science, including neuroimmunology, biochemistry, molecular and cell biology, genetics, neuropathology, toxicology, virology, bacteriology, allergy and autoimmunity, rheumatology, physiology, social science, and health services research. And vaccine science in the 21st century will not only have to pass peer review of the medical community, it will also have to withstand the scrutiny of hundreds of millions of educated healthcare consumers in the U.S. and around the world. At the end of the day, the goal should not be to conduct science for the express purpose of defending existing public health policy. The goal should be to conduct science that illuminates truth about the impact of infectious disease and vaccination on human health for the purpose of improving the safety and effectiveness of future public health policy. If the science determines that certain vaccine policies must be modified or even abandoned to improve human health, that is a reality and that public health officials and doctors must be prepared to accept and address. Although governments could choose to apply economic or other societal sanctions to temporarily force purchase and use of multiple vaccines by the educated middle class, force will never stand the test of time, especially when the World Wide Web can outreach mainstream media, now strongly influenced by industry and government, and shine a bright light on inadequate science, propping up questionable public health policy. The two IOM committees, which was charged by Congress under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, with evaluating the medical literature for evidence that vaccines can cause injury and death, pointed out in 1991 and 94 that, quote, there are many gaps and limitations in knowledge bearing directly or indirectly on the safety of vaccines. This includes inadequate understanding of the biologic mechanisms underlying adverse events following natural infection or immunization, end of quote. Little has changed in the landscape of new vaccine reaction research funded by government and industry since that assessment was made by the Institute of Medicine 20 years ago. And yet, as I highlighted in my 2008 review of the medical literature in my book, Vaccines, Autism, and Chronic Inflammation, The New Epidemic, from smallpox and polio to pertussis and rubella, the medical literature dating back to the turn of the last century is already rich with evidence documenting that the complications of vaccines containing lab-altered viruses and bacteria are identical to the complications of infectious diseases caused by those same viruses and bacteria, with immune-mediated brain inflammation being the most feared complication of both infectious diseases and vaccination. The fact that vaccines also contain protein and protein particles, metals, formaldehyde, phenoxyethanol, polysorbate 80, MSG, foreign DNA, and adventitious agent contamination from animal and human cell substrates, none of which has been systematically studied for their effect on human health, means that significant questions remain about what kind of biological damage vaccines could be doing, including potentially destroying chromosomal integrity. Unfortunately, many doctors and vaccine consumers alike have no idea how little medical science knows about how and why vaccines injure and kill, or how and why some individuals suffer serious fatal complications from infectious diseases, while the majority recover without sequelae. This fundamental lack of basic science knowledge about the biological mechanisms of natural or temporary immunity following infectious disease or vaccine exposure is why vaccine makers have always struggled and failed to create vaccines that are both effective and safe for everyone. As an educated healthcare consumer, when I look at the quality and quantity of vaccine science, I see large gaps in knowledge that must be filled to demonstrate that national vaccine policies are improving human health at the individual and population level. as a vaccine safety and informed consent advocate for 3 decades, having served for more than 20 years on vaccine advisory and research committees at the Department of Health and Human Services and the Institute of Medicine, during which I articulated the vaccine safety concerns of educated healthcare consumers. Following is my perspective. I will begin by asking a question that I asked myself in the early 1980s when I was researching and writing the book DPT, A Shot in the Dark, which I co-authored with medical historian Harris Coulter and was published by Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch in 1985. That question is, why did my precocious little boy, Chris, suffer a vaccine reaction that left him brain injured, while Chris's good friend, Timmy, who lived across the street and also got 4 DPT shots, did not suffer a vaccine reaction and went on to become a straight-A honor student? Between 1983 and 1985, while I was interviewing more than 100 parents of DPT vaccinated children, whose case histories were detailed in A Shot in the Dark and later reviewed by an Institute of Medicine committee for the 1991 IOM report on adverse effects of pertussis and rubella vaccines, I concluded that biodiversity is part of the answer to that question. That is, there are genetic and biological differences among individuals that, depending upon the types and numbers of vaccines given, along with the potential influence of other environmental cofactors combined, to make the host vaccine interaction a very risky one for some children like my son. Like most Americans, I am of mixed heritage, part Norwegian, Irish, Scottish, English, German, and Jewish. Our family has been populated with teachers and writers, doctors and nurses, musicians and artists, builders and business owners, soldiers and historians, and with our contributions to society, we have carried with us a genetic vulnerability to atypical immune responses, manifested by a history of severe food, environmental, and prescription drug allergies and autoimmune disorders, including rheumatoid arthritis, thyroid disorders, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, eczema, and migraine. My mother, a nurse, died of lupus. My father wears a penicillin allergy bracelet. My grandmother died of Parkinson's. My children's biological father, a member of Mensa, has multiple sclerosis. My oldest son suffered a serious neurological reaction to DPT at age two and a half and did not completely recover. My youngest son developed a pseudotumor of the brain after he received DT and oral polio vaccinations at age 4 and thankfully did fully recover and went on to graduate with honors from high school and college. The day Chris received his 4th DPT shot, the evidence suggests he was biologically, environmentally, and genetically at high risk for a DPT vaccine reaction. First, he had suffered a severe local reaction to his 3rd DPT shot. Second, he was not entirely well the day of vaccination because he had recently completed a 10-day course of antibiotics and still had mild diarrhea. Third, he had a personal history of milk allergy and a strong family history of allergy and autoimmunity. And fourth, he was injected with a crude whole-cell pertussis vaccine that contains, among other ingredients, first, pertussis toxin, which is a lethal toxin still used by researchers to reliably induce brain inflammation, specifically experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. After lab animals are injected with pertussis toxin, they suffer encephalopathy manifested by varying degrees of brain dysfunction. Pertussis toxin is still bioactive in DTaP vaccine because it is chemically and not genetically detoxified and can revert to toxicity. Endotoxin, which is a lipopolysaccharide that is part of the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria and produces a defensive inflammatory immune response, including the release of histamine, which can lead to swelling, diarrhea, collapse, shock, and death. Antibiotics kill bacteria rapidly, and the dying bacteria release large amounts of endotoxin in the body. There is still bioactive endotoxin in DTaP vaccine. Aluminum, as an adjuvant, could stimulate the immune system to mount a strong inflammatory response. Injected aluminum is associated with chronic brain and immune system dysfunction. Mercury, as a preservative in the form of thimerosal. Injected mercury is associated with chronic brain and immune system dysfunction. The day that Chris got his 4th DPT shot, for him, it was a perfect storm. And nobody, including his mother and doctor, knew it. Why? because back in 1980 there had been little bench science conducted for the express purpose of understanding the biological mechanisms for vaccine injury and death. There were no scientific studies systematically investigating potential environmental, biological, and genetic factors that place some individuals at higher risk than others for suffering vaccine complications, including 1, revaccination after severe local reaction, 2, vaccination during acute illness or recent recovery from illness, 3, vaccination during antibiotic or recent antibiotic use, 4, personal history of allergy or autoimmunity, including milk or gluten allergy, 5, strong family history of allergy or autoimmunity. 30 years later, there is still no real acknowledgement by mainstream medicine that the unique combination of genes we are each born with, the genes which give us our individual physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses, our special talents and limitations, and which play a major role in defining who we are and who we will become, can also make us more or less vulnerable to suffering complications from atypical manipulation of the immune system by vaccination. There is open acknowledgement that genetic variation plays a role in individual susceptibility to prescription drug reactions that kill more than 100,000 people in the U.S. every year and injure more than 2 million. But there is little or no acknowledgement that genetics plays a role in individual susceptibility to vaccine reactions. And if emerging scientific evidence linking major histocompatibility complex genes responsible for allergy and autoimmunity with above-average intelligence is demonstrated, then one-size-fits-all universal use vaccine policies may be penalizing the brightest and the best, with profound consequences for every society. Other potential cofactors that could raise the risk for development of brain and immune system dysfunction include exposure to pesticides, chemicals, and other environmental toxins, overuse of antibiotics and prescription drugs, nutritionally compromised and contaminated food sources, and unhealthy lifestyles. But there is a compelling argument to be made that the dramatic increase in chronic brain and immune system dysfunction in children in the past half century, especially the rising number of reports of regression in previously healthy children in the past 3 decades, is due to an early environmental exposure that has been experienced by all children, but which is harming an expanding minority of them. Many biological responses are at least partially under genetic control. If, for example, adverse responses to vaccination are tied to the genes responsible for predisposition to autoimmunity and immune-mediated neurological dysfunction, it is possible that the addition of more doses of vaccines to the routine schedule in the past 2 decades has affected more and more children with just that genetic predisposition. So the pool of genetically susceptible children has not changed, but the environmental triggers have increased. Therefore, when all children were only exposed to DPT and polio vaccine in the 1960s, a small fraction of those genetically vulnerable to vaccine complications responded adversely. But with the addition of the combination MMR to the routine schedule in the late 70s, and then HIV, hepatitis B, and chickenpox in the late 80s and 90s, more of those of the genetically vulnerable that could not withstand atypical manipulation of the immune system by vaccination have been brought into the vaccine average responder group. This was the hypothesis I presented in 2001 to the Institute of Medicine Immunization Review Committee. In their 2002 published report on multiple immunizations and immune dysfunction, this is how IOM addressed that hypothesis. Quote, "The committee was unable to address the concern that repeated exposure of a susceptible child to multiple immunizations over the developmental period may also produce atypical or nonspecific immune or nervous system injury that could lead to severe disability or death," Fisher, 2001. "There are no epidemiological studies that address this. Thus, the committee recognizes with some discomfort that this report addresses only part of the overall set of concerns of some of those most wary about the safety of childhood immunizations," end of quote. Unfortunately, the validity of most epidemiological studies that have investigated and dismissed chronic health problems associated with vaccination has been compromised by what is not known about the biological mechanisms and genetic high-risk factors for vaccine complications. This lack of knowledge has made it far too easy for doctors inside and outside of government to put policy before science by using an a priori assumption that vaccination is safe and that increased use of multiple vaccines over the past half century has not negatively affected the long-term health of many children and adults at the population level. It is an a priori assumption that is as unscientific and potentially dangerous as the assumption that an individual child's regression following vaccination is only coincidentally and not causally related to vaccination. Without pathological profiles to define vaccine-injury and death, the coincidence assumption will continue to be used to dismiss vaccine adverse events in clinical trials and those reported to the vaccine adverse event reporting system for the purpose of maintaining the status quo with all the inherent risks that assumption carries with it. Epidemiological studies will continue to be fatally flawed by the coincidence assumption and the absence of objective science-based criteria for determining what is and is not vaccine-induced. This is especially true when, for the past 30 years, the great majority of American children have been vaccinated with at least DPT, MMR, and polio vaccines. Therefore, the true background rates in unvaccinated children for mental retardation, medication-resistant seizure disorders, learning disabilities, ADD, asthma, diabetes, and other chronic disease is unknown. And that's why, for the past decade, the National Vaccine Information Center has been calling for a large prospective case control study similar to the Big Heart and Cancer studies that last several decades, which would enroll children at birth and compare short and long-term health outcomes of three groups of children: those who receive all government-recommended vaccines on schedule, those who receive fewer vaccines, and those who remain unvaccinated. We maintain, however, that they should not just look at all morbidity and mortality outcomes and compare rates of these chronic diseases in the three groups, but they have to have a bench science component that evaluates pathological changes at the cellular and molecular level to measure over time the similarities or potential differences in immune and brain development and function between the three groups. The potential role that vaccination has played in the current epidemic of chronic disease and disability, often marked by chronic inflammation in the body, cannot be separated from the simultaneous lack of exposure by children to once common childhood infectious diseases. The specter of the hygiene hypothesis looms over an international vaccine program that is encouraging the development of more than 200 vaccines now in stage 3 trials around the world, many of which will be marketed worldwide and added to the mandatory list in America. Medical science must find out whether mass vaccination programs have harmed childhood health, not only by repeatedly atypically manipulating the immune system during the developmental period, but also by removing early experience with childhood infections that may have naturally assisted with effective immune system development, preparing the way for healthy immune and brain function throughout life. And medical science would do well to remember the lessons learned from overuse of antibiotics that have created lethal antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria, as evidence is already emerging to suggest a similar threat is posed by the overuse of vaccines, begging the question, who in society should have the power to conduct an uncontrolled, unmonitored scientific experiment on mankind by re-engineering the natural order in a vacuum of scientific knowledge without knowledge of the potential for a catastrophic outcome? Politicians bowing to pharmaceutical company lobbyists eager to cash in after September 11, 2001, on the national fear of well-publicized, still phantom bioterrorism weapons, did not consider this when further protecting industry and public health officials from liability for vaccine injuries and deaths. Finally, I cannot close without briefly commenting about mandatory vaccination policies and the ethical principle of informed consent to medical risk-taking, about which I have written extensively since 1996 and which will be the main focus of my work from now on. Because vaccines are pharmaceutical products that carry an inherent risk of injury or death, which can be greater for some than others, informed consent to vaccination can be defined as a human right. One-size-fits-all mandatory vaccination policies are, in part, a de facto selection of those genetically vulnerable to vaccine injury and death for sacrifice in the name of the greater good. There is nothing moral or noble about a government health policy that punishes individuals for the genes they inherited. Therefore, the seminal 1905 U.S. Supreme Court case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which gave the states power to mandate vaccination based on a utilitarian rationale popular at the turn of the 20th century, was a deeply flawed legal decision from a medical and ethical standpoint. The danger inherent in that flawed legal decision was best illustrated when, in 1927, U.S. Supreme Court jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes used Jacobson to justify the state-enforced sterilization of a woman judged to be mentally retarded. Justice Holmes said flatly, quote, "The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes." The discrediting of the utilitarian pseudoethic that doctors and scientists charged with crimes against humanity utilized to defend themselves at the doctor's trial at Nuremberg after World War II made it clear that when the greater good is defined by those who benefit from devaluing the life of the individual in order to force sacrifice of some individuals for the theoretical well-being of others, the very fabric of civilized society is torn apart. The human right to individual autonomy and self-determination when making life and death health care decisions must trump any public health policy requiring individuals to engage in medical risk-taking without their voluntary informed consent. There is no single freedom that is more important to defend than the freedom to decide what you're willing to risk your life or your child's life for. Because without that freedom, we are all vulnerable to exploitation by those wielding power without conscience. When I became a mother, I learned for the first time how vast the boundary of human love really is and how strong the biological imperative can be when it comes to a mother's natural instinct to protect her own child from harm. There is nothing on this earth that can compete with a mother's innate instinct, which is hardwired into her DNA to make sure her child survives. Public health officials and doctors promoting the mandatory use of vaccines in a vacuum of scientific knowledge should remember that when placing a higher value on the elusive community immunity than on the life of a single child. In the 21st century, the crisis is upon us, and there is no time to waste, because what may be at stake is nothing less than the biological integrity of the human race. Enlightened doctors and scientists with courage and integrity, like those gathered at this conference, can help reinstill public trust in medical science and change national health policies to make them safer. By laying aside a priori assumptions, you can create new vaccine science to help replace old vaccine policy that has failed so many. And then those for whom the risk of vaccination has been 100% will no longer be swept under the carpet, and the way will be open for vaccine safety and compassionate public health policy to become a national priority for every nation.
We wanted to do this show about vaccination, and we wanted a well-rounded show that had some personal information in it. And if you look at what is going on with Barbara Lo Fisher, and you look at the number of resources that she uses from journals, this information is out there. It's just being ignored. We wanted to do this show in response or in support of the show we did yesterday about pre-vaccination risk factors. And in that show, it's 2 hours, it's a workshop. We provide the software, the manuals, and the class for you, the public, to have a way to test your children before and after. This would be a way for us, we the people, to put ourselves back together that the government has torn asunder. The government and big pharma and the people who look to the population as a test pool. When you look at these vaccinations and you see that one of the results is obesity, and then you look at one of Obama's new mandates that they're trying to pass, any child that is obese should be taken away from their parents and put into a special camp, because making your children fat is child abuse. when all along, according to Barbara Lo Fisher, it could be the result of a mandated vaccination. We have found a way to begin to reverse the damage, and we've already done it in over 300 kids, two of them my own grandchildren. You have that opportunity to take this to the people in your family, in your community. Please look on our site. Make sure that you have a link to next weekend's repeat of that class. We have had some great conversations during the show. I'm being told that Blog Talk Radio is still broadcasting. So they may be broadcasting, but I don't know if it's being archived. We'll check with that in about a half hour or so after the show. In the meantime, we are going to be doing a special workshop at 2 o'clock. And this workshop is really a movie. It's called Soylent Green. And then Mike Adams is going to talk about the very recent Time magazine, How to Die. And you're going to see that in the Soylent Green movie, and that was done in 1978 with Charles Heston, and it was says, okay, 2022, you can see that we are there now. The movies predicted what's happening now and how it's only going to get worse unless we the people step in and do something and have choice and power over our own health. I would like, this is a private workshop, but I would like to invite all of you to be there. And this profile that I'm showing, yes, my moon has made arrangements for you guys to have copies of it if you want, but I'm going to go to my email, maybe, I can find it, and I'm going to give you good stuff here. I'm going to give you the link to join this very private meeting for our professionals, because we all need to have it. Let me see if I can find a new message. Sound new. Vaccination risk factors. That's not it. If anybody sees it here, it's up and coming pre-vet giveaway. Sunday class with Sherry. See if this is it. 1:30. I think this is it. Doesn't say what we're going to be talking about. So I'm going to take this link, copy it, and put it in the chat for everyone here so you can join us to see what we're trying to accomplish from a professional level. Yes, we provide some of these things on a public level to give you guys the opportunity to raise funds to pay for the professional course. We're trying to make it complete for everyone. Okay, let me put in the rest of these pieces here. There are many of you here who are practitioners. Let's see, other languages. But the overall view of this, as you can tell from Barbara Lo Fisher's speech, is that, here, I'll put support in here, is that our entire gene pool is being ruined, and she has the data, and she has the proof, and the people who are putting the money in their pockets from these mandated vaccinations don't really care. just like the Attorney General in, I think it was Maryland, who forced all the school kids to get vaccinated and some again at gunpoint. He didn't have his own children vaccinated. One of the things that you see again and again with this is that it dumbs down the population so that they can't think on a very simple layers or levels. Here's three things, go do it, and they can't think about that. But they can think about Plato's Republic. Is this deliberate? I listened to a show today about Gardasil and hormones. And we can show that Gardasil, this HPV, human papilloma stuff, really is an anti-fertility drug. They're coming at us from all layers, from radiation. And by the way, any of you who want that radiation software, it is up waiting for you. And excuse my typing in your ear, soundhealthoptions.com/radiationclass.html, and I hope I'm spelling all that right. That's waiting for you. Send it to your friends. If you love this archive, please send that link to your Facebook. Get people involved. It will cost them a microphone, $25 or less. You and your boyfriend dining out for an evening, $25 or less buys you a microphone, and the rest we provide. Please get involved. Please send this Blog Talk Radio link. And Richard, are we still on with Blog Talk? Is that going on? Yes. So I don't know if they've recorded the whole show, but it would be wonderful if they did. And if not, just go to Barbara Lo Fisher's YouTube Vaccine Safety Conference opening address. Vaccine Safety Conference opening address. Barbara Lo Fisher. We have done her vocal print. We know she's telling the truth. We compared it with Paul Offit, who we know is not telling the truth. So please help us share the idea of self-health and self-responsibility, and help us find those trainers and teachers and practitioners that will help us put a bioacoustic center in every community. I certainly thank you for being here. I'd like to stay and answer some of these questions you guys have put in here, but I have that other show that I have to set up for, so I certainly appreciate you being here. If you want a copy of that transcript, Moonstone has put the address up for you, sherryedwards@gmail.com, and I'll send that to you. We are still getting bombed on our website. They have taken down all of the links to the things happening this weekend, and I can't have staff. Well, I don't have the money to have staff on call 24 hours a day to fix everything. So we are going to try to put an event calendar up in some place that's secret or something, so that all of you who are interested can get to that events calendar and get the links to everything that's going on. So for those of you who want to join us at 2, we will be right back, and we certainly appreciate your being here today. You got your info from the forum. Okay, that's good. There are so many people helping us, Joanne. People have come out of the woodwork to help put back together all the stuff that's been destroyed. I don't know if you know or not, but we have a restraining order against people for crashing into our website. There is, perhaps a separate public Google. Yeah, that's a good idea. Richard, we can do that. There is a Guardian class this evening, and it is called Sleep Disorders. So we hope to see you Guardian people join us then. Talk to you later.